Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to New Books in Gender and Sexuality Studies, a podcast from the New Books Network. I'm Isabel Machado and I'll be your host for this episode. And today, I'm talking to Dr. Stephen K. Stein about his new book, Sadomasochism and the BDSM Community in the United States, Kinky People Unite, which was published by Routledge in 2021. The first comprehensive history of this subject, the book chronicles the development of sadomasochistic sexuality and its communities in the United States from the post-war period to the present day. Associate Chair of the Department of History at the University of Memphis, Dr. Stein works in the histories of the U.S. military, technology, and more recently, the history of sexuality. He has written on topics ranging from ancient battles to aviation and the iPod. His other books include From Torpedoes to Aviation, Washington Irving Chambers and Technological Innovation in the New Navy, The Sea in World History, Trade, Travel, and Exploration, and 25 Years of Living in Leather, the National Leather Association. Steve, welcome to New Books in Gender and Sexuality Studies.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So if you're familiar at all with NBN interviews, our first question we usually ask our guests to introduce themselves, tell us a bit about their careers and their trajectories. I am asking you that, but I must first make a confession. I was a PhD student there at the History Department of the University of Memphis and was very recently back there as a postdoctoral fellow, so we were colleagues. But I had no clue that you were a fellow sexualities historian. I only associated you with military and technology history until I, you know, found out about this book. So yes, I would like you to tell us a bit about your trajectory, but I'm particularly curious about how and when did you begin your work in this particular subject?
I started out as a military historian. I did my doctoral work back in the 90s at Ohio State. Which is very well known for its military history program. I worked with Alan Millette and Joe Gilmartin and a number of the other military historians there, working on kind of technology in the U.S. Navy, the professionalization of the Naval Officer Corps, the beginnings of naval aviation, and which was my dissertation and became my first book. I've been at University of Memphis about 20 years now, and the person that got me involved in the history of the BDSM community is a person I met fairly early in my career, and that's Jan Hall, and who's mentioned in the book. She contacted me back when she worked for one of the big textbook publishers. I forget which one, but she needed someone to do kind of textbook reviews to make sure they're passing state standards. At that time, I was still working as an adjunct at the University of Memphis before I'd kind of clawed my way into an instructorship and then onto the tenure track. So I did that work for Jan, kind of going over all these kind of high school textbooks and writing out, filling out the reports they needed to submit them to the state school boards. And then many, many years later, she contacted me. And what she'd seen is that a lot of the kind of the very important people in the BDSM community had died or were in poor health. Jan was actually president of the National Leather Association in the late 90s. which, you know, I didn't, you know at the time when I first met her. So she had all these contacts, and she was watching people die, and she wanted kind of the history preserved. And she remembered me and contacted me, and that's how I got involved in the first book, 25 Years of Living in Leather. They wanted an official history of the National Leather Association, which I wrote. And then having done that for them, which turned out to be a much more involved project than I'd originally thought it would be, it made sense to me to, you know, since I had all these contacts in the community, already done the research to move further afield. And I was quite surprised to kind of see that historians have virtually ignored kind of the leather community, the BDSM organizations, and so on, that we've left this for social scientists to write. So for me, it's a unique opportunity, right? As a military historian, I'm, you know, in a fairly competitive field where, you know, my friends are writing, you know, the next book about, you know, whichever battle already has 10 books about it. So it was a lot of fun to go in and be pretty much the first person, the first historian, at least, kind of looking at these groups.
Before we get into the actual history that you're covering here on this book, could you please walk us through some of the basic definitions and terminology? I think many of us still confuse or conflate BDSM, S&M, leather, DNS. Tell us why you decided to use BDSM throughout the book. How do you define and use the term here?
Okay, that's a great question. And BDSM has become a popular term for a number of reasons, and I think not least of which is that it's the term the community itself has embraced. And these come out of prolonged debates within BDSM organizations about what they wanted to be called. They early on rejected sadomasochism and because that seemed to them to kind of represent someone like Jack the Ripper, right? Criminal, non-consensual violence. And they experimented with all sorts of terms. S&M, as you mentioned, sometimes SM or S/M. Other people wanted to get away from, right, the sadomasochism in general. So dominance and submission was popular for a while. DNS or D/S. And another term that was popular for a while was bondage and discipline. SM and DS were by and large used by early BDSM organizations. Bondage and discipline was a term favored by professional dominatrixes. So you'd see it in classified ads, right? People would advertise interest in or services of bondage and discipline. So all these terms and several others were floating around for a while. Some people pushed restraint and pleasure for a while, R&P. And we get BDSM largely because of the internet, that in the early alt.sex.whatever, right, the early Usenet groups, a lot of leading members of the BDSM community participated and argued about these terms, repeating debates that had already begun in the early SM organizations, like Society of Janus, founded in San Francisco in the mid-70s, had a lot of these debates. And at some point, and I don't know anyone's ever going to kind of nail it down exactly, someone just suggested, well, let's just ram all these through. So you get BDSM because it's seen to include B&D, bondage and discipline, DNS, right, dominance and submission, and then, right, the old term, S&M, S/M, and such. So that's BDSM. And I went back and forth. Different drafts of this book use different terms because for most of the period I write about, S/M was the preferred term. But it's awkward when you're writing, as you can imagine. And it has fallen out of favor. It's at least early on, BDSM had very much a straight connotation, whereas gays and lesbians who were doing the same things often preferred to associate themselves with a leather community and refer to themselves as leather men or leather dykes, right? Tying into kind of a larger group, only some of whose members engage in BDSM activities. But they too, over time, have kind of embraced it. So it made sense to me to use BDSM, and simply because increasingly that's what other people around me. I was quite surprised when one of our colleagues at University of Memphis kind of walked by and said, "So, Steve, you're now researching BDSM, right?" So the term is out. It's what people are using. It's what the community has embraced. So it just seemed the way to go. And of course, for the title, I went back and forth with the publisher on titles, and the idea was to get as many Amazon search terms into the title as possible. I suspect that's true of most authors these days.
But tell me a bit about your research process. Which sources did you use? Where did you find them? And was this any different from your previous research on more, for the lack of a better term, mainstream topics?
Yeah, it's very, very different. First off, it's some oral history that I could meet and talk to some of these people. I talked to Jan Lyon, one of the founders of the National Leather Association, shortly before she died. Of course, I could talk to Jan Hall and some other people and cross-check things that way. I made a lot more use of magazines. The BDSM community, especially in the 80s and 90s, had a remarkable amount of magazines and other publications coming out that I could dive into, particularly Drummer, aimed at the larger male leather community, but of course specifically aimed at BDSM. Our Dungeon Master magazine, founded by Tony DeBlase, and then he later launched Sam Utopia Guardian, S&M Utopia Guardian, which was aimed at a pansexual audience for everyone. So there's a very rich, amount of information in these magazines, club newsletters, and zines. And there is, in fact, an archive that has stored some of these things. It's the Leather Archives and Museum in Chicago, which began essentially as a dream by Tony DeBlase. He's this very central figure in the community, publishing books and magazines, running his own SM toy company for a while. But out of his archives, this larger archive developed, which has a lot of resources there. It's got the records of the National Leather Association, records of a number of other organizations. So in that sense, it's an archive, and an archive is an archive. What was interesting about this, it's not true so much anymore, but when I was first there, they were just getting started. So I actually got to go through unprocessed boxes and literally completely unprocessed boxes. So I would, I'd open up a box and, there'd be what I was looking for, a club newsletter or, minutes of an important meeting or something. But right next to it would be page proofs for a magazine, photographs from their latest dungeon party, all mixed together. So that made it a little different than the Library of Congress or the National Archives.
That sounds fascinating. You write here that the BDSM community demonstrates how a minority sexual community can pursue sexual citizenship. I think this is an important and interesting concept. Could you talk a bit, explain what is sexual citizenship?
I suspect different scholars would give you different definitions, but fundamentally, it's at least for members of the BDSM community, they want to be able to be out about their sexuality for it to be public. It's very important to some of them, and not suffer any repercussions for that. Not fear for losing custody of their children, which was very common and happened to a number of leading figures in the community. Not suffer career problems. To be able to have their play parties and not have them raided by the police. Which was a routine through the 1970s and 1980s. These parties had to be arranged in secret. So yeah, it's a full and public participation in society. And others would go so far as to say without, people looking down on them, right? That BDSM would be, as accepted and would not raise eyebrows playing golf or participating in football games or other kind of vigorous sports. They frequently make that comparison, that you can get a lot more injured in a football game than you're going to get, you know, at the average BDSM dungeon play party.
So let's get into the history here. Tell us how this story begins. I would like to know about the early process of building BDSM networks.
Okay. That was one of the decisions I had to make with this book, is when to start. Because, of course, people have been engaging in these activities for a while, certainly back into the 19th, 18th century, right? We can find European bordellos that specialized in flagellation, right? People who wrote admiringly about it. But the beginnings of the community, as you mentioned, kind of this early networking is just getting started before World War II, and the war shuts it down in a whole host of ways. And then it picks back up again after the war. And one of the more interesting figures is John Coutts, who wrote in the name John Willey, who came to the United States from Australia, already part of a network of people interested in bondage and other BDSM play. And he got connected via friends in Australia to people who shared his interests in New York. And he launched one of the first publications aimed at kind of fetishists, sadomasochists, called Bizarre. And his success inspired other people to launch similar magazines, particularly Leonard Bertman, who's a much more successful businessman than John Coutts was, who launched Exotique and several others. And these early business people, these early publishers, began attracting people around them. And these magazines eventually allowed personal ads to be placed so that people could find each other. And it begins a process of networking as people across, at least throughout the English-speaking world, which is kind of where my kind of research was centered, could find each other. And at least in these early days, one gets the sense that these were probably upper middle class people, right? People who could travel to meet each other, to arrange, small gatherings, even either one on one or perhaps, small groups. And these ads became more common over time. What particularly caught me by surprise was that there used to be a publication in Canada called Justice Weekly, whose nominally was about criminal justice reporting, and yet another one of these kind of like true crime publications, except it didn't censor its adult ads, its classified ads in any way. So increasingly, people with diverse sexual interests began advertising in Justice Weekly, right? Swingers, right? People interested in BDSM, gays and lesbians looking for friends and so on. There's diverse people of diverse sexualities. And these connections eventually, and I wish I could kind of, nail down exactly when or why, but these networks eventually blossom into organizations, just a few at first, and they all form the early 1970s. In New York, it's Eulenspiegel Society, which later just adopts its initials, TESS as its name. Because so many people had trouble pronouncing Eulenspiegel, I imagine. Society of Janus forms in San Francisco a few years later, 1974. And in between them, in Chicago, the Chicago Hellfire Club forms, which Janus and Tess were open to everybody and had early on, right, straight members, gay members, lesbian members. Chicago Hellfire Club was men's only and very much coming out of the out of the tradition, relatively recent tradition, obviously, of gay motorcycle clubs, right? So it had adopted the trappings of these fraternal leather organizations. And unlike Janus and Tess, which advertised, Chicago Hellfire Club operated almost as a secret organization. They didn't publicize themselves. You found out of it by word of mouth. And these organizations eventually inspire others.
I was really fascinated by your description of Bizarre magazine. I kind of wanted to read it. In the second chapter, you paint a pretty vivid picture of the beginning of the first BDSM organizations and the flourishing of leather bars, as you mentioned, in the 1970s. But the part that really caught my attention was your discussion of women's groups. Could you talk a bit about the role that BDSM played in the 1970s feminist sex wars?
Okay, absolutely. And on Bazaar, it has been reprinted. It's a German publisher called Taschen, and they've reprinted a number of old sex magazines, and Bazaar is one of the ones they've reprinted, so you can get it. Women in the leather community had all sorts of problems, both in terms of if they were cruising traditional gay men's leather bars, or if they were joining groups like Tess or Janice, right? So, most leather bars excluded women. There were a few who could, in a certain sense, prove themselves, assert themselves, have male friends, get them in. But there are relatively few of them who could do that. And even they would suffer from kind of problems, in the bar. Right. Comments of, the fish have arrived and things like that. Something smells like, something smells fishy and so on. So they weren't a lot. Most of them weren't kind of comfortable in that environment. And within groups like Tess or Janice, there were other problems, and particularly ill-behaved straight men hitting on the women, regardless of whether they're interested in them, regardless of whether they're dominant or submissive, right? So kind of broader problems in our culture, being exacerbated in a BDSM environment. So increasingly women look to form their own organizations, and most of them are open to all women, straight, bi, lesbian. It starts in Janice. They form a women's only group called Cardia. And that then, a number of the women in that group wanted to be in a purely women's group away from men. And they're the ones who form Samwa, which has a number of important early members. Pat Califia, now Patrick Califia, a longtime writer on sex and sexuality, longtime advice columnist for The Advocate. And of course, Gail Rubin. Right, involved in these organizations, right? An important anthropologist, right? It's around the same time that she's kind of writing her landmark essays, like Thinking Sex. And what Samwa discovered, all these early BDSM organizations had trouble finding places to meet, right? If you're going to have a organization, you have to go somewhere. You have to have your clubhouse, as it were, meeting space. In the case of Samwa, they assumed that the growing number, kind of, that they would tap into, as you mentioned, kind of the growing women's network of women's bookstores and other kind of businesses catering to women. And instead, they found themselves excluded, that BDSM was condemned as violence against women, as patriarchal, and so forth. And the women in Samwa decided to push back very hard. So rather than retreating and being quiet, in a certain sense, rather than being, say, like the Chicago Hellfire Club of just relying on their own resources and avoiding people, Samwa pushed back very hard. They had letter writing campaigns aimed at women's publications, like especially Off Our Backs for long-running disputes. And these disputes spread into women's and lesbians magazines and newsletters in general. All through the early 80s. Now, I suspect, part of what you're getting at, of course, is this culminates at the famous conference at Bernard, where Rubin is one of the speakers, and members of women's anti-pornography groups picket the conference. So it is a very big, very divisive discussion within the women's movement as to whether BDSM sexuality is appropriate, right? Whether, the participants have internalized patriarchal violence. And the issue is never really settled. It kind of dies down and resurfaces periodically. So you saw the debate resume again right after the publication of 50 Shades of Grey in 2011, right? These same debates come out. Are women, acting out, male violence, even if it's a lesbian couple and such. What's interesting for the development of the BDSM community, and again, something that caught me by surprise, is that the women coming out of Samwa all then form, you know, occupy very important, very influential places in the BDSM community, that they actually dramatically shape how a lot of the important BDSM organizations develop, particularly the National Leather Association, which for a long time insisted on co-equal male and female co-chairs, at a time when women may have represented 10-15% probably of the organized BDSM community. You know, so a lot of the structures, a lot of the outreach, a lot of the rhetoric inside the community comes out of Samhwa. It's a very influential group that published two books. The one that really caught people's attention was Coming to Power, a collection of essays and erotic stories and poetry and so on. The organization itself, though, Samhwa, fell apart, at least in part because most of its members, which is probably fairly typical of the BDSM community, didn't want to be part of a politically active publishing apparatus. They just wanted to have a good time and go to parties.
So then you show us that BDSM groups proliferated in the 1980s, and you explain the process of unifying the BDSM community by the end of that decade. And I was wondering, what impact did the HIV/AIDS crisis have in these developments? And the second question I would like to ask about the 80s is, how did the focus on safe, sane, consensual come about? So two big questions, sorry.
It's interesting because my original assumption, and you do hear people say this, that the BDSM community becomes so organized as a result of the HIV crisis. But as I looked closely at this and kind of looked at these dates, you see that it's happening before, right? Two really important New York groups are founded in 1980, so right before the AIDS crisis. The Lesbian Sex Mafia, which is actively involved in the counter demonstrations at the Bernard Conference, and GMSMA, the Gay Men's SM Activists. So they're already, these new groups forming in cities across the country, including one in Denver, where I lived at the time. Denver area dominance and submissive. But what HIV does is it accelerates that process. In a couple ways. First, it dramatizes the importance, really for the gay community as a whole, that they needed to get politically organized, right, to raise consciousness about a host of issues, but particularly AIDS, right? And that was certainly driving Steve Madoff, who founded the National Leather Association in 1986. But there's other processes kind of pushing this too. Part of it is that the leather bars themselves were serving a very narrow constituency. As one person, David Stein, kind of complained, it was basically, the bars were the place where the reckless and the beautiful hung out. And there were lots of people like him who were a little overweight and a little balding and wanted, a place, that was open to everybody. Not just the reckless and the beautiful, and also that engaged in more serious discussion of BDSM and even heavier BDSM play. Again, very surprising. You think about the stories one hears about these bars was anything goes. And yet, if you look at the community's literature and their complaints, they see the bars as a very sexual environment. But in terms of BDSM activities, somewhat tame. So people are looking for an alternative to bars. They have organizational models like Tess and Janice, both of which either formed auxiliary chapters or Tess had ambassadors in other cities that were kind of helping organize groups. The bars themselves are somewhat alienating to a growing number of people. And because of AIDS, a number of the most famous bars were shut down. The Mineshaft in New York shut down during Ed Koch's administration. Catacombs, very famous in San Francisco, shut down on its own before being forcibly closed. Other bars did the same. So HIV plays a role in this and I think accelerates developments that are already taking place, this increasing organization of the BDSM community. Dungeon Master Magazine, a magazine focused not on dirty pictures and erotic pictures, but very specifically on BDSM technique, launches 1979. Right. So again, right before before AIDS.
Right. And the other question was, how did the focus on safe, sane, consensual come about?
Absolutely. Right. Sorry about that. Every early BDSM organization coined some kind of phrase that they used. It was in part, as you said, right, it's a way to push back against the people condemning, right, BDSM, to say, you know, we're not fascists, we're not Nazis, we're not criminals. What we do is safe. Tony DeBlas and Dungeon Master starts using the phrase safe and sane, which he may have just adopted because there used to be a campaign in the United States to celebrate a safe and sane 4th of July, right? So for his generation, the phrase may simply have been in the air, right? Have a safe and sane 4th of July. Don't get overly drunk, you know, don't blow up anything. Don't hurt yourself. But other organizations had different phrases that lay like, and there, of course, right, consent very early, very quickly figures in all these discussions, right? All these groups, in a certain sense, are taking in the 70s, in particular, a consciousness-raising approach. And so they're constantly discussing, debating, well, what makes what we do different, right? What makes us not, right, Jack the Ripper, violent criminals, and so on. And they very quickly kind of focus on, well, consent. And you can find references to it in a few BDSM publications, certainly by the 1960s. But there are other more interesting phrases floating around, right? Some of the Samois in its phrasing used the term non-exploitative, which I think is much more interesting, right? Already grappling with something that we talk about a lot today, right? Is that consent is not necessarily, you know, a yes-no, right? Question, right? Consent can be coerced and manipulated in various ways. But safe, sane, consensual, once it was coined, it was coined by members of GMSMA, right? People who know Tony DeBlas, who are reading Dungeon Master, attending the parties organized by the Chicago Hellfire Club. So they're getting the safe and sane from there. And consent seems to be true of every BDSM organization. Very quickly, created some kind of credo involving consent. And GMSMA is the one who kind of fused the slogan and just began promoting it. And in its day, GMSMA, I mean, they shut down a few years ago. But in their heyday, they were an incredibly large BDSM organization, several hundred members, and incredibly adept at fundraising. So for many years, they were the leading contributor, right? The number one contributor to the Pride Parade in New York, yeah, to the Gay and Lesbian Resource Center in New York, and other charities. And so you had the largest, most effective BDSM organization promoting the slogan. And it was GMSMA, several of their leaders, but particularly Barry Douglas, who convinced the organizers of the March on Washington to include, for the first time, an obvious leather BDSM, march contingent. They'd been banned. And this is pretty true of most pride parades in the 70s, right? They banned visible participation of leathermen. But Douglas got that contingent approved. And as part of that organizing, they promoted, right, they put safe, sane, consensual in all the march literature. So you began then seeing the phrase popping up in the National Leather Association's newsletters and other publications. And then after the march was 87, the march in Washington, 1988, there's a big gathering of BDSM organizations in Dallas, of all places. And that meeting, there's a lot of nasty debates that people are still angry about, but they all agree that safe, sane, consensual is a good phrase. And that's the phrase the community embraced and promoted. And it's still the phrase most people use. There have been various people trying to challenge it, and they've not gotten a lot of traction for a whole host of reasons. I think safe, sane, consensual works for the BDSM community. And it does it in two ways. One is, of course, kind of externally, right? Leave us alone. Don't harass us. Don't arrest us, right? Don't condemn us. What we do, right, is safe, it's consensual, and it's sane, right? Pushing back against, you know, definitions of alternate sexuality that condemned, right, BDSM activities, you know, in like the diagnostic standard manuals of the American Psychiatric Association. But it also is useful internally, right? That once you're having people getting together, having, right, dungeon parties, play parties, they usually call them, where you might have dozens or more people, you know, mixing around, meeting people, engaging in BDSM activities. It gives you a standard to police conduct, to keep people safe, to keep your party safe. You know, so it works, like I said, both internally and externally. And it's been applied to things beyond BDSM activity. I think one of the things that most struck me, it was just a letter I found by accident going through the National Leather Association's papers, but it was a person writing in complaining that at the last convention, or living in leather, they had been non-consensually subjected to cigarette smoke, right? So taking safe, saying consensual, right, what's used to kind of keep people safe in the dungeon, and then broadening that out, I thought was very interesting to address other issues of health and safety.
You conclude the book by discussing the paradox of mainstream acceptance. I'd like to know what you mean by that, because that's sort of a discussion I've had with previous guests in this podcast. You know, we've been talking about what is gained and what is lost when a marginalized subculture goes mainstream.
Oh, okay. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's... Yeah, for the BDSM community, this is a long-running debate. One of its one of the best-known authors, right, John Preston, you know, writing erotic stories that feature BDSM, you know, and kind of rough sex, early on saw this the community getting increasingly organized and was appalled by it, right, and kept pointing out to people, but we're supposed to be outlaws. We're supposed to be sexual outlaws. How can you have a meeting using Robert's Rules of Order, right? If we're outlaws. And I've been to some of these meetings, and they really do. It's like some of my faculty meetings, and not the more interesting ones. You know, following Robert's Rules of Order. And that's yeah. And as you said, I mean, it's true of any number of marginalized sexual communities. I mean, like we were talking about a few minutes ago, right? Pride parades, right? What are you allowed to do in a pride parade? You know, are you allowed to let it all hang out, right? And say, this is gay culture, right? Accept us as we are, right? Or are we all supposed to, you know, are you supposed to show up in a jacket and tie and, you know, look just like everybody else? And for the BDSM community, there are people who start feeling increasingly constrained by this, right, complaining about that there is a, you know, an SSC, a safe, sane, consensual thought police, right, that, right, the joke is, right, my kink is okay, but your kink is, you know, should be illegal, right? People trying to, within the community, kind of demarcate what is or isn't acceptable, and there's no solid agreement on what that is or isn't. So there's all sorts of long-running debates in the BDSM community about what is or isn't safe, sane, consensual. Breath play, for example, right? Erotic asphyxiation, right? Restricting airflow to someone to increase, you know, sexual pleasure. Some people condemn it, or some people, of course, are doing it. So within the community itself, right, these debates are there and very active. But at the same time, right, members of the community would like their play parties, right, to be safe, to not have the police infiltrate and bust up parties, as was relatively common. You know, last raid that I think I tracked down was 2001, 2002. So that's the plus side, right, of the mainstreaming of it is that there is less police harassment. But there's also, right, there's a cartoon in a BDSM magazine that I ran across, and it's a woman dressed as if she's interested in BDSM, right? So with visible piercings, a collar, right, studs, leather, and such. And you know, the word bubble coming from her says, could you believe that? That guy thought I was into BDSM, right? How could he think, right, such a thing? You know, and this is a long-running complaint in the community, right, that people who dress the part don't act the part. But it's not, there doesn't seem to be any way to resolve it. There are people who are angered by this, and there remain small groups that kind of keep themselves at something of a distance from the organized community, I think specifically because this. There's a group founded in, men's group founded in California, and one of their early advertisements says, leather and sadomasochism have become almost indistinguishable, and you know, we're changing that, right? We're putting a certain sense, the S&M back into S&M, right? To make it raw and raunchy and dirty and hardcore again, right? We're going to kind of decivilize it, if you will.
Yes, and you mentioned here that with this mainstreaming came fragmentation, right? How did that happen?
Okay, yeah, and that's again something I found very interesting. To a certain extent, especially the mid-80s, and part of it, as you said, is being driven by the community's political agenda, right? The recognition, right, that the BDSM community is very, very small. Yeah, much to their leaders' frustrations, no matter how many sex surveys indicate that perhaps 10% of people may enjoy some kind of BDSM play or spanking, bondage, so on. It's a much, much smaller percentage of people who will subscribe to a BDSM technical magazine, who will join a BDSM organization, right? So they very early on recognize that, right, if they're going to have a voice, they need to come together. Men's and women's groups, gay, straight, so on. Everybody need to form one cohesive community to try to get a larger voice, to try to be heard. Right, what Barry Douglas is trying to do at GMSMA, right, participating in the March on Washington, what Steve Madoff was trying to do organizing the National Leather Association, right, to take these small disparate groups, form a community. And it really was a very small community. The largest BDSM convention of the kind of early 90s was 1994 in New York. It's for the 25th anniversary of Stonewall. And it maybe had 3,000 attendees, right? And this was the event to go to. So, you know, the community as a whole, right, is being measured probably in tens of thousands, right? So they wanted to, they needed to band together. But as you mentioned, right, having then achieved, right, a lot of their goals, right, that they've ended police harassment, that a lot of the negative stereotypes have disappeared. There are people who are very open about their BDSM sexuality, right? That 50 Shades of Grey, right? Commonly discussed. And in the absence of an external threat, the community began fragmenting back into its constituent parts, right? So instead of kind of the pansexual ethos that was very aggressively pushed in the 1990s, especially by the NLA, that we should all be working together, politically. But also playing together, right? Right. That in dungeon parties, was encouraged, for example, for gay men and lesbians, right, to participate in scenes together, not sex, but BDSM. These various constituent groups began breaking apart again, right? So straight BDSM groups form, women's only groups, more of them common. Right, Guy Balls, one of another leading figures in gay BDSM organizations, start talking about that gay men have given so much that they're losing something by participating in this large community, that it's time for them to pull back and focus on their own needs. And the absence of a major threat, there wasn't a reason to bring people together anymore. I mean, one of Guy Baldwin's other crusades, and he speaks about this a lot, is he wants sadomasochists to stop using pseudonyms, right? To use their real names as he does, to kind of expiate that last remaining shame of it.
So just to conclude, I wanted you to talk a little bit about something that you discuss here. You say that BDSM is one of the best documented examples of social construction of a sexual practice and community. This is, again, an important discussion, debate in sexuality studies. Could you explain this? Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that to me is one of the fascinating things about BDSM is the sheer quantity of technical literature. You have publications whose sole purpose is to teach technique, how to tie people up safely, where and how to beat them, how to make whips, how to hide your home dungeon, right? So your parents don't discover it when they visit you. So there's this vast technical literature that is out there, and that as you then get BDSM organizations, the standard format of the meeting, once they conclude whatever, you know, Robert's Rules of Order stuff they need to get rid of, you know, vote on the budget or whatever, is to have a discussion and some kind of demonstration of BDSM technique or BDSM related technique, perhaps tattooing or piercing, but especially fancy rope bondage is incredibly popular. You know, tying people up in interesting ways, whip making and other, right, how to make your own restraints and such. BDSM equipment is not cheap. So there's lots and lots of discussion, demonstration of how to make your own toys or to find what they call pervertibles, right? Something that's not meant for BDSM play that you can adopt. And within this, you then, and you can go to conferences and literally watch the presentation of whatever it is, flagellation, fisting, and so on. And then later on, go to the dungeon and watch people doing this. And in fact, saying, no, the presenter said to do it this way. So you literally have the kind of social construction of their sexuality, both in print and you can just watch it taking place. You can watch new ideas and new trends spread through the community. When blood play, right, got popular, there's nothing on it for many years. And then suddenly, right, you see a bunch of articles pop up on cutting and blood play and how to do it safely, on where to get your supplies and so on, piercing, long whips, right? If you kind of look at most kind of pictures of BDSM activity, the whips are usually multi-tailed. They call them floggers. You know, they're short. They're meant to be used safely in confined spaces. But in the mid-90s, suddenly long whips got popular, as long as bull whips, right? 8, 9, 10 feet long. And a whole host of bullwhip experts emerged in the community, right, did their demonstrations, and it actually became a point of pride for some in the community to master a long whip, which is a very difficult technique. And you can definitely put someone's eye out with one of those things. As I said, you can literally see it taking place in the literature, or if you attend the events, it literally social construction. And you can see the flip side too, right? Where them trying to ban certain activities too, right? Don't do things, right? So you know, both education and constraint.
But I also found it interesting how they're constructing the meaning of this practice and this community and changing the meaning through the period that you cover here in the book, right? This process of mainstreaming is also part of that. Are you working on any new projects that you wouldn't mind sharing with us?
I continue to have myself in three different areas. So I'm currently editing a collection of articles that we hope to have done soon on teaching history online. We started work on this right before COVID, and then all my contributors got very, very busy. So we're a little bit behind where we'd like to be. But obviously, of course, COVID underlines just how important it is to look at history education beyond the classroom, right? To go online, right? As you do with this podcast. For the BDSM work, I am looking at going back to the archives and perhaps looking at Tony DeBlas, who I have only mentioned him a little bit, but he's an incredibly formative figure in the community. He just dominates the community for roughly 20 years by publishing Dungeon Master and other publication. He had his own BDSM toy company for a while, Samatopia Supply Company. And again, one of the interesting things I found this, I may be showing my age, but when I was a kid, we built model rockets. And one of the fun things about building Estes model rockets is that when you bought the engines for your rockets, they came with little tech notes that explained basic rocketry and aerodynamic principles, right? So you're a kid, you're a young teenager, and you're kind of learning rocketry and you get examples of doing it. And Tony DeBlase is doing the exact same thing with with BDSM toys. He'd include little tech notes, instructions, right, how to do that. So I'm certainly looking at kind of following up this book and perhaps looking even more closely, right, at the social construction of BDSM sexuality and the role that someone like Tony DeBlase and some other kind of publishers and educators played in it. And when I get back to military history, I still want to write a book on kind of focusing on kind of the 1950s and how people imagine the future of war. Kind of jetpacks, Starship Troopers, that sort of thing. So three very different projects.
Yeah, but they all seemed really interesting. I just wish your book was around last semester when I was teaching a U.S. History of Sexuality class. I would definitely have assigned it. I hope folks will take a look at it, and it was very useful for me. So, Steve, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me.
Oh, I was happy. It was a lot of fun.
And to our listeners, thank you for tuning in to this episode of New Books in Gender and Sexuality Studies, a podcast from the New Books Network. I just spoke to Dr. Stephen K. Stein about his book, Sadomasochism and the BDSM Community in the United States, Kinky People Unite, which was published by Routledge in 2021. I'm Zeba Machado, and until next time.